Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Right. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Despite continuing violence between Israelis and Palestinians, there's also continuing talk of trying to stop it. Egyptian mediators assembled Palestinian militias today to try to engineer a ceasefire. Joining us on the line from Jerusalem is Christian Science Monitor correspondent Cameron Barr. Cameron, thanks for speaking with us.
Good to be with you.
Cameron, tell us first about Egypt's involvement, this assembly of militias. What are they up to, and what are these American guarantees we hear about?
This is a longstanding effort, several months old, to try to get the Palestinian factions to agree to a ceasefire that would allow the diplomacy to proceed a little bit. It's failed several times already. Most of these meetings have been held in Cairo. There's been a new effort now in the past few days. And at least the early reports coming out of Gaza are saying that this effort has also failed to achieve a breakthrough. As far as the guarantees are concerned, I can tell you that Palestinian Authority Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas, or Abu Mazen, he was asked about this at a press conference last week and dodged the question. And so I think there's a great deal of uncertainty as to whether these guarantees actually exist.
What would the guarantees be?
Number one on the list these days is to cease the policy of assassination or targeted killing. Israel claims the right to kill Palestinian militants or terrorists who they say are planning an attack.
The guarantees could also include an Israeli pullback from northern Gaza, right? Is that in the air over there today?
Yes, possibly also the West Bank city of Bethlehem. And this echoes an earlier Gaza and Bethlehem first pullback plan of several months ago that also proved fruitless.
It does not sound from your tone, Cameron, that there's a lot of optimism over there despite this movement today.
Part of that may be that I've been talking to Hamas hardliners today, Abdulaziz Rantisi, who was the target of an assassination attempt last week, and he's categorical that there won't be a ceasefire. Mm-hmm. So that's one reason for my skepticism. And I think there's another big-picture dynamic here, which is that the Israelis, the choice that they want to offer Hamas is the choice between ceasefire or full-scale attack by Israel. That may explain why we've seen such a concerted effort on the part of the Israelis for the past few days to kill Hamas militants, despite the civilian death that these attacks sometimes cause. And that's a policy that echoes the larger American policy in the war on terrorism. So I had a non-American diplomat tell me today that while the Americans expressed disapproval of these assassination attempts and called them unhelpful, in reality, they don't think that that's wrong because it comports so nicely with the sort of black and white nature of the war against terror.
Just to boil it down to finish up, Cameron, what's your sense of the likelihood of a ceasefire and an Israeli pullback from northern Gaza?
I'd have to say slim at this stage. But as I say, I've been talking to hardliners, so yeah. You know, that doesn't leave a lot of room for optimism.
Skews your vision a little. Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas will also be meeting with militia leaders in Gaza today, and certainly there is some motion in the direction of compromise. Palestinians outside the hardliners are thinking something could happen, yes?
Yes. I mean, there's a case to be made here for the angry middle, a rising proportion of people who are just sick to death of the conflict and sick to death of the way that the conflict impinges on their daily lives.
Cameron Barr, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Cameron Barr is a correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor. We spoke to Cameron from Jerusalem.
Well, it may seem a distant prospect now, but the roadmap to Middle East peace calls for a provisional agreement on the borders of a Palestinian state by December of this year. But before negotiations on those borders even begin, construction is well on its way on what may amount to a de facto border. Israel is building a several hundred mile long fence dividing Israelis and Palestinians. But some say this real world barrier, meant to stop suicide bombers, may also be a barrier to peace. Edward Sheehan is a novelist and longtime Mideast watcher, the author of The Arabs, the Israelis, and Kissinger. He joins us from Jerusalem. Good afternoon, Edward.
Good afternoon, Robin.
Let's begin with a physical description of the fence. It's not a picket fence by any means.
Oh, on the contrary. In fact, it's, in many ways, it's not even a fence. It's a wall, which has barbed wire fencing on either side. And it has deep ditches and watchtowers, and it's quite wide.
Isn't there a similar wall already between Israel and the Gaza Strip? And some say that's what's protecting Israel from suicide bombers coming from the Gaza Strip.
Well, yes, there are such barriers, but I'm not sure what a protection it can be or that any wall or fence can be, because people find ways around it. And this includes not only violent people, but people simply migrating in search of work.
Mm. Well, tell us about the construction of this wall.
Well, it began, I believe, several years ago under the previous prime minister, Ehud Barak. But what it does is cut deeply in some places into the West Bank, surrounding Israeli settlements and, in effect, expropriating land. So the question is, obviously, is this the new border of Israel?
Mm. And how much land would you guess?
Well, in the present phase, it will be probably at least 2%. In its final phases, when it's completed, if it ever is completed, it may be more than 10%.
So what's your sense of the impact of this fence or wall on the current peace process?
Well, I had a long meeting with President Yasser Arafat and his Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas in about mid-May, and they said it was absolutely impossible to accept this wall or fence, and that for a final peace treaty, it must be removed.
Well, 70% of Israelis, in a poll of a year and a half ago, believed that the wall was necessary. But those Israelis who opposed it, some of them anyway, felt that it was giving the Palestinians too much.
That's true. The extremist settler parties in Ariel Sharon's government want all of the West Bank. And amongst those, the most extreme want what they call transfer of Palestinians out of the West Bank into Jordan, which means expulsion. So there is a wide disagreement among Israelis about it, but Israeli liberals, who are not inconsiderable in number, are firmly against it, firmly against it.
But doesn't the building of this wall also indicate a willingness, at least on the part of the Israelis, to have a border? I mean, a border in itself says that you are a border with a state.
Yes, but they are prohibited by international law from being in the West Bank at all or from transferring Israel's own citizens into occupied areas. Everyone needs a border, that's true. But the question is, would it be a legal border?
And what do you think, Edward? Do you think that the line of this wall is going to stay through the process, or will it have to be changed?
I don't see how it can stay if there is going to be a final peace agreement.
Well, Edward Sheehan, thank you.
Thank you.
Edward Sheehan, the author of The Arabs, the Israelis, and Kissinger. For a link to his most recent article in the New York Review of Books, visit our website, here-now.org.
A management school researcher recently set up job interviews for 38 MBA students at the University of California at Irvine. It was for a job paying $61,000 a year at a company named Indostar. Now, the job doesn't exist, nor does Indostar. It was an experiment to see if men and women handle job interviews differently. According to this experiment, they do, especially when it comes to money. Lisa Barron is a professor of organizational behavior at University of California, Irvine's Graduate School of Management, and she joins us now from Long Beach, California. Welcome, Professor Barron.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us, Professor. 21 men and 17 women interviewed for this non-existent job. What was the major difference in how they presented themselves in the interview?
Well, the most striking thing that I found was that women asked for significantly less money than the men did.
Hmm. What do you make of that?
Well, I was quite interested in this myself, and in post-negotiation interviews, what I discovered was that the men and women had different belief systems, and that these belief systems were related to their requests.
Huh. Now, was this a dramatic difference in the kind of salaries they were asking for?
Well, it was not a huge amount, but it was statistically significant. Future increases are usually a percentage of salaries, and so even a very small initial difference of, say, $1,500 is compounded over time, and it can end up being quite significant.
Sure. So how did their belief systems about themselves differ, men and women?
Well, what I found was that women tended to be or to feel that they were entitled to the same amount as what other colleagues were receiving, whereas the men indicated that they were entitled to more than these colleagues were receiving.
So were men lying about their qualifications, exaggerating their qualifications?
Well, a couple of things contributed to that. One is that the men were much more comfortable with the whole idea of their worth and equating that worth with a dollar amount. So they were much more comfortable saying, I'm worth $72,000. Whereas the women were not as comfortable with this whole concept, did not like thinking of themselves in terms of worth, and weren't even really comfortable evaluating themselves that way. So I think that's one factor that can contribute to the entitlement.
Hmm. Now, are we talking about something in women's wiring here or something that they just engulf from the culture?
Dangerous question.
Yeah, and a hard one to answer.
I have no idea about any genetic or biological reason for this, and I can't really think of anything. But there certainly are cultural reasons why this difference might exist. For one thing, women tend to get paid less than men, which might make them think, okay, I can't ask for as much as a man can. For another thing, and this is more my personal sense of it, is that men's identity tends to be centered around work,
right,
whereas women's identity may not be as focused on work or as dependent on work. But I'm not sure about that.
Let me ask you just briefly, the people doing the interviews, both men and women?
No. The people doing the interviews were women.
Huh.
And so that is an interesting area to investigate further. What happens if you have men doing the interviews as well?
Yeah. Interesting study. Thanks very much for joining us and talking about it.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Lisa Barron is a professor of organizational behavior at UCAL Irvine's Graduate School of Management.
Just ahead, rumors of resignations on the Supreme Court and their ramifications.
And later, unsettling predictions from the CDC on diabetes.
And startling new theories about the role monkeys and chimpanzees have played in spreading the AIDS virus.
There's more coming up here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by WB56, where meteorologist Mike Wonkum has New England covered. From Gloucester to the Cape, Worcester to Boston, Mike Wonkum's forecast tonight on the 10 o'clock news on WB56. And Virginia and Eric Truwergy, supporting a new capital campaign for Mass General diabetes research and treatment. Details at massgeneral.org/diabetes. This is WBUR.
Which of the following did Houdini fail to escape from? A coffin buried in sand, a set of Scotland Yard shackles, or a giant tank filled with beer? It was the tank of beer. Come sample more moderate quantities of beer and ale from dozens of breweries at the WBUR Brewers Offering and Food Expo this Saturday. Enjoy beer, food, games, and prizes, all while helping to pay for the news. For tickets, call 800-909-9287.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The U.S. Supreme Court released a flurry of decisions this morning, among them a ruling which limits how much a mentally ill defendant can be drugged in order to stand trial. Another upholds a government ban on campaign contributions from lobby groups. But as the Supreme Court wraps up its term, some in Washington speculate that two judges, Chief Justice William Rehnquist and Associate Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, may be wrapping up for good, retiring, in part so that President Bush can replace them now and avoid bruising confirmation battles while he seeks re-election. Well, it's been three decades since the High Court has seen such high turnover, and critical issues like affirmative action and abortion hang in the balance. Here to put it all in perspective are members of our D.C. Roundtable, David Shribman, executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Hi, David.
Hi.
And Jack Farrell, D.C. Bureau Chief of the Denver Post. Welcome, Jack.
Hello.
Well, David, back to you. This court's been together for, what, 9 years? But it's closely divided, and another seat could open up if President Bush elevates an already sitting justice to the Chief Justice seat. So give us some thoughts. What do you think's going to happen?
Well, a whole lot can happen, or nothing at all can happen. As you say, they've been together for 9 years. Not impossible that they'll be together for another year or two, but it's also increasingly likely that one or two of them will depart, and it will change the chemistry of the court and change the sociology of the nation.
Well, Jack, let's take a look. If it is Chief Justice Rehnquist, there's a lot of speculation that, as I said, he'd be replaced from within the bench. Your thoughts?
Well, the speculation is that Chief Justice Rehnquist would retire and that possibly Sandra Day O'Connor would be made Chief Justice for only a short time, because she's pretty advanced in years as well. And that may actually be the factor that works against her.
Yeah, there's other speculation, David, that Clarence Thomas could be named Chief Justice because he's younger than Antonin Scalia. Any thoughts there?
Well, I think if they're looking for a brutal, bitter, long, bloody, divisive, and probably unresolvable conflict, that's what they'll do, because they'll get that in the Senate. I'd be very surprised if they went to Clarence Thomas. It was bloody the first time around. It would be even worse the second.
Well, but is that maybe that the point, Jack, that they want to do it and get it over now?
No, I don't think so. I think that Bush spent most of the first couple of years in office making sure that he would not get challenged from the right in his primaries. He's secure in that now, and I think what you're going to begin to see for the next year is him paying attention to the general election, showing a little bit more of the compassionate side. And so I don't think he's looking for a big, bruising battle. The other thing to consider, though, David, is that as long as Bush is extraordinarily popular, Rehnquist is liable to say, well, you know, I can stick it out to another term, no?
Yes, I think that's possible. I think Rehnquist is looking not only at the actuarial tables, but at the poll results. And if you look at the two of them, he figures, well, what the heck, I might as well hang around. I like this job. You know, it's a good job, and of course he likes the outfits because he designed them himself.
Well, what would the politics of Judge Rehnquist mean? I mean, for instance, it's thought that if he's replaced by another conservative, it wouldn't tip the balance in, let's say, the abortion rights voting. But if, for instance, Justice Paul Stevens resigns, wouldn't that have a different impact?
Definitely.
Where is Justice O'Connor seen, David?
Well, she's seen kind of in the middle, but I want to urge all of you to think less about mathematics and more about chemistry when we're talking about the court. You know, the numbers and how the court breaks down will probably be the same, 5-4, 4-5, whatever. But the chemistry will change, and the chemistry is what's really important in this most mysterious branch of government. It affects the kind of decisions they reach, who writes the decisions, and the way the court proceeds. And that's a very important, very subtle part of it. And I know Jack studied this very, very much. I'd like to hear what he thinks about that.
Mm-hmm. O'Connor is so fascinating because she has been that fifth vote on many, many a case. She's a very important swing justice, and the things that she's done over the years have really helped define this court. So that would be a big change in the chemistry.
And speaking about Justice O'Connor, some say that the affirmative action case at the University of Michigan could be her last ruling. And, you know, she was considered an affirmative action baby herself as the first female justice. Do you think she's going to stick around for that vote?
Well, she'll certainly stick around for that vote. But I think all of us have come to the conclusion, whether right or wrong, that this entire debate over affirmative action in the Michigan case have been an effort to sway one person. And that one person is Sandra Day O'Connor. And her position in the center of one of the most important debates in the country may affirm to her the importance of her job and may suggest to her maybe it's time not to leave.
Hmm. Well, if someone leaves, you move to the question of whether or not President Bush is going to get his nominee. The Senate Democrats have been digging in their heels over lower court nominations. Will he get the necessary votes, President Bush, to avoid a filibuster?
Well, it all depends on who he picks. If he picks a hard right young person that looks like they're going to be around and cement that conservative coalition, then that person's going to meet resistance. And a large part of the battle over the lower federal courts in the Senate has been Senate Democrats and liberals sort of sending a message saying, you want to fight? This is what we're, you know, we are together. We don't care about the op-ed columns. We will fight you tooth and nail on this.
Well, before we let you go, get out your day planner. Jack Farrell,
yep.
What do you think is on the agenda this week in Washington?
The thing I'm going to be watching the most closely is the work on the prescription drug bill. Right now, it seems that as part of a Medicare package, the United States government is going to be creating a new entitlement, so to speak, which would be opening the door for Medicare payments for prescription drugs. And they're actually going to be getting into the nitty-gritty in the House side of hammering out what this bill is going to look like and whether or not this sort of shaky consensus goes all the way through to last and can go all the way through to the White House will depend a lot on how flexible the House will be in the next few weeks.
And David, to President Bush, who was vacationing in Kennebunkport, for a while we thought might have taken one of those vacation bumps and bruises. He fell off one of those Segways, those motorized scooters. But do you think he's going to be present this week in conversations about the Middle East?
Robin, a segue about the segue. I think you've outdone yourself. I don't think it's possible for the president, who after all got these talks underway, to distance himself, particularly when everybody on all sides, right and left, Palestinian and Israeli, agree the most important person in these talks is President Bush.
Well, I want to thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
David Shribman, executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and Jack Farrell, D.C. bureau chief and assistant managing editor of the Denver Post.
Tomorrow, the elusive truth behind the collapse of an American family in the new documentary, Capturing the Freedmans. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Skinner Auctioneers, currently accepting antiques, including furniture, paintings, and jewelry for its summer and fall auction seasons. Auction schedule online at skinnerinc.com. And the Huntington Theater Company, presenting the jazz musical Cookin' at the Cookery, The Music and Times of Alberta Hunter. From June 20th to the 29th only, huntingtontheater.org. Come explore the countryside and distinctive cuisine of Tuscany and Umbria with Silvia Poggioli. That's on our next Citizens of the World tour this summer. Proceeds help pay for the news. For more information, call 800-909-9287. Still to come on Here and Now, we'll hear about a community of artists with disabilities and check in with folk music critic Scott Olerick about independent record labels. This is WBUR.
Hi, it's us, Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers. You know, there's been a lot going on over the last 12 months.
Yeah, I mean, I took 336 naps. I drank 527 cappuccinos.
Actually, I was talking about the real world. And think about it. WBUR was here every day to keep you informed.
Now they need your help to finish paying for this unprecedented coverage.
So help them now with a pledge, and you'll be entered into a drawing for a brand new Toyota Prius hybrid. Sweet, huh?
Just log on to WBUR.org for details and thanks.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, a new study predicts 1 in 3 American kids will develop diabetes in their lifetime.
Something is occurring which we never expected, and that is a dramatic increase in the diagnosis of type 2 diabetes in children.
Also, tracing AIDS through the African food chain.
And why does Compass Records thrive while the mainstream music industry flounders? Because of artists like Paul Brady.
His songs have been recorded by Mark Knopfler, Bonnie Raitt, Tina Turner, Cher, Dave Edmonds. These guys are artists who are known for their taste in songwriters.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. U.S. troops swept through towns and villages west of Baghdad after dawn today, arresting suspected resistance leaders and searching for outlawed weapons. Meanwhile, the military says four Americans were hurt yesterday in a pair of attacks. Lourdes Navarro has more.
At least four Americans were wounded, two of them seriously, in two attacks on Sunday. The U.S. military says that in the town of Al-Mushahida, 15 miles north of Baghdad, unknown attackers fired a rocket-propelled grenade at soldiers from the 4th Infantry Division. It also hit a civilian bus. U.S. Central Command says the number of casualties on the civilian bus is unknown. At least two U.S. soldiers were seriously wounded in that attack. Also Sunday, assailants fired rocket-propelled grenades on a military convoy near Ad-Dujail, a town 35 miles north of the capital. Two soldiers were lightly wounded there. Lourdes Navarro, Baghdad.
There are Egyptian calls for a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, but Israel's foreign minister says the militias should not be bargained with. And a Hamas leader says this is no time for a truce. Palestinian Authority Foreign Minister Babil Shat says an international force wouldn't be needed if both sides would accept the roadmap to peace.
If everything succeeds in the next 2 days and the Israelis accept their responsibility and abide by a ceasefire, as our people will do, then there will be no need now for international force. But if nothing else succeeds, I would like to see this as a viable potential.
Palestinian officials say they're hoping for a more positive answer from the militants tomorrow. A group of more than 250 Iranian writers and lecturers is urging Iran's supreme leader to give up the idea that he is God's representative on earth. The group says they stand behind week-long protests calling for democratic reforms in Iran. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has the final say on matters in the country. The Supreme Court today put limits on the government's ability to force defendants to take antipsychotic drugs in order to stand trial. A majority of the justices say the Constitution allows the practice only under some circumstances. The ruling applies to nonviolent defendants. And in a preview of the upcoming campaign finance battle, the court ruled today that the government can ban contributions from advocacy groups. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is up 146 points at 9262, and the Nasdaq is up 29 at 1655. It's 33 past the hour. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Trader Joe's, a grocery store where shoppers will find a variety of foods and beverages like seafood and meats for the grill, savory marinades and organic lemonade, TraderJoe's.com, and by WGBH2, presenting La Plaza, Judge to Janitor, the true story of Luis Velez, a Colombian judge who traded his elite stature to become an immigrant laborer in the U.S., tomorrow night at 7:30 on WGBH2. In the forecast today, this afternoon, we're calling for a mix of sun and clouds, highs near 70 inland, but quite a bit cooler along the shore. Tonight, clear and chilly, down into the 40s in some areas. Tomorrow and Wednesday both look mostly sunny and warmer, with highs well into the 70s. And Thursday, the forecast calls for a chance of showers in the 70s. 58 degrees right now. In sports, Pedro Martinez gets the start for the Sox in Chicago tonight as the Red Sox take on the White Sox.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
A new study from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention predicts that 1 in 3 American children will become diabetic in their lifetime. 1 in 3. And for Hispanic children, the odds are worse. 1 in 2 is expected to be diabetic by the year 2050. The prediction is about triple the current American Diabetes Association estimate, which was thought to be bad enough. Dr. Nathaniel Clark is Vice President of Clinical Affairs at the American Diabetes Association. He's read the study. Hello, Dr. Clark.
How are you?
Well, I'm fine, but these estimates are appalling. Is this possible? It's triple your group's predictions.
That's right. And what it shows is that we really need to very seriously look at how to change the way things are going in order to prevent all these people from developing diabetes.
Well, remind us first, doctor, there are two types of diabetes, type 1 and 2. A quick definition of each.
Type 1 diabetes is a disorder of insulin deficiency. So insulin, which is a hormone necessary to use sugar within the body, is simply not produced. type 2 diabetes is more a disease of insulin resistance, where the insulin in the body may or may not be present, but it simply does not work well. And therefore, these patients all need diet and exercise prescriptions. Many need oral medications, and some go on to need insulin as well.
Are the findings of the studies and other studies, do they apply to both of these types of diabetes? Tell us.
No, they apply to type 2 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes is really quite a different disease and is thought to be an autoimmune disease, meaning it's a disorder of the immune system.
You just don't produce it.
That's right, and it really is not as linked to the lifestyle issues as type 2.
Well, what can people do faced with this?
Well, I think the most important thing, which is very simple to say but very hard to do, of course, is to make, you know, the necessary lifestyle changes in regard to getting diet under control, and if we're physically inactive, to become, you know, physically active on a regular basis.
And as we're seeing in this study, we're talking about children who really don't have as much control over their lifestyle.
Exactly.
Yeah. So,
and that's why in it with children, we have the opportunity to really try to get these kids started on the right path so that they don't get to the age of 20 and 30 having had bad habits for so many years that then they need to break.
Which then also, as we have learned, imprint on their body.
Exactly.
Whether or not these children have been diagnosed.
Indeed.
Yeah.
You know, we know that there is a tremendous increase in pediatric obesity. We also know that something is occurring which we never expected, and that is a dramatic increase in the diagnosis of type 2 diabetes in children. Mm-hmm. Type 2 diabetes was always thought to be more of an adult disease, 40 to 50-year-olds, et cetera. We're now seeing it, you know, relatively often, particularly in high-risk groups such as African-Americans, Latinos, Native Americans, et cetera, in these children who are overweight and are developing diabetes, that it's type 2 diabetes, not type 1.
And, Doctor, why the increased risk in Hispanic children and other minorities?
We don't know exactly. There are probably two major components. One is there's probably a genetic component that puts them at higher risk to develop diabetes. And then there's clearly an environmental component that as these people tend to be poor and to have poor eating habits and to have less access to organized physical activity, you have the two, one on top of the other.
I'm thinking, Doctor, as well, this comes also at a time when we're cutting school lunches and physical activity.
Exactly.
Dr. Nathaniel Clark, thank you. Some disturbing news.
Indeed.
Dr. Nathaniel Clark is Vice President of Clinical Affairs at the American Diabetes Association.
Several years ago, researchers said they had evidence that the AIDS virus first reached humans who ate chimpanzee meat. Now scientists are taking the theory a step farther. They've traced the virus back to monkeys that the chimpanzees had eaten. A study conducted by British and American researchers and published in the journal Science says it was a combination of viruses carried by two specific monkeys, both eaten by a chimp, that morphed into the virus we now know as HIV. Joining us to discuss his research and its implications is Paul Sharp, the lead author of the study. He joins us from England's University of Nottingham.
Hello there.
Dr. Sharp, tell us how you believe the AIDS virus reached humans.
Well, the AIDS virus in humans, HIV-1, is most closely related to a virus found in chimpanzees, and so humans must have picked up the virus from chimpanzees. What we've been interested in then is where did the chimpanzee virus come from? Mm-hmm. And what we've now found is that the chimp virus is a combination of two viruses found in monkeys in West Central Africa. Part of the chimp virus is closely related to a virus in a species called the red-capped mangabey, and the other part of the chimp virus is most similar to a virus carried by monkeys called the greater spot-nosed monkeys.
Now, why is it important to have figured this out?
Well, what we'd like to know is more about SIV infection in chimpanzees.
SIV meaning?
The family of viruses found in chimpanzees and in monkeys, which are the relatives of HIV in humans.
Right, right.
Chimps don't seem to get sick when they're infected with this virus, whereas obviously humans, who are very similar genetically to chimpanzees, do get ill. So that would be one thing that would be a goal of many researchers in this area. But we'd also like to know more about the whole biology of infection of chimpanzees.
unusual for two or more viruses to combine to form a new virus?
It's not so unusual in this area. We know within humans, HIV-1 has diversified into many different subtypes. So all it seems to require is that a single individual, whether that's a human or a monkey or a chimpanzee, is infected at the same time by two divergent strains. Once that happens, those two divergent strains can recombine together to form a hybrid.
Also interesting in the study that believe now that the first human contracted the HIV virus between 1910 and 1950. Why did it take so long to spread?
If you simply think about the dynamics of this, for a virus to get from one person to infecting, say, over 40 million today, takes a very long time for that amount of spread. And so in that light, it's not too surprising that the virus didn't really come to recognition until the early 1980s.
Huh. Does that suggest that other viruses could be incubating in human beings?
There's always that possibility, although, of course, the special thing about the viruses that cause AIDS is that they can infect individuals for many years before they even show any symptoms. That obviously is in stark contrast to something like the SARS virus, where the symptoms show up very quickly. It reinforces the idea that people in Africa should really stop hunting and eating chimpanzees because we don't know what other viruses chimpanzees may have picked up. For a start, with this family of SIVs, we know of more than 30 different species of monkeys that are each infected with their own strains. And so it could be that chimps in hunting monkeys have picked up other forms of SIV that we haven't yet detected. And, of course, if those viruses can spread in the chimp population, they could easily be transmitted on to humans.
Dr. Paul Sharp, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Dr. Paul Sharp is a researcher at the University of Nottingham. He joined us from Nottingham, England.
Still to come, the little independent record label that could, Compass.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Gateway Arts is a gallery in Brookline, Massachusetts, where artists with special skills and special needs spend the day creating the work that's shown and sold at the gallery. Here and Now intern Marisa Fanchini recently paid a visit.
I'm Ray Edelson, and I am the administrator for Gateway Arts, which is an art center for 95 talented adults with disabilities.
What do we have here in front of me? I have some beautiful postcard-sized paintings, and what are they all about?
Right now, Marisa, you and I are looking at some beautiful pieces of art by a gateway artist, Ruby Pearl, who is self-taught. Ruby has a unique vision. She has a series of paintings called Solitude, which depicts women who are alone, but not sad. They're strong. They are beautiful. There is something seductive about their aloneness. There's an introspection regarding art and identity. The colors that you look at them, I think, are beautiful. There's another piece that you and I are looking at, which seems like a piece of German expressionism to me. It's a visual representation of Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht.
Ruby Pearl. I'm an artist at Gateway Arts. I've been able to begin to express the emotion starting from my depression once I started to come here because I was so emotionally disturbed when I came here and grew to so much joy because of their encouragement. I grew out of my depression and I'm able to give myself the ability of joy and happiness in my home as well as here at Gateway Arts.
are doing what they have dreamed of, when they are getting recognition they have never had before, instead of being sick, instead of being cranky at a very high level, instead of having symptoms that are disruptive and would be considered asocial, they work productively. It's beautiful to see people work here. And there is something absolutely mesmerizing about seeing people with disabilities work totally motivated, totally focused on what they are interested in, on their vision. There's something beautiful about seeing that with people without disabilities. And that's what's important about this art center. It transcends disabilities.
Here and now, intern Marisa Francini paid a visit to Gateway Arts. Gateway Arts is a project of the VinFen Human Services Organization. For more, go to our website, here-now.org.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, also by Tufts Health Plan's Health eAccess, offering online capabilities to meet the needs of employers, members, and providers. Details at TuftsHealthPlan.com. By Swiss International Airlines, announcing all flights will be arriving to and departing from Terminal E at Logan Airport as of June 17th, that's tomorrow. Information and reservations at 1-877-FLY-SWISS. And by Crescent Ridge Dairy, the dairy that delivers, offering home delivery of farm fresh milk in glass bottles, now available at Bread and Circus Whole Foods Market and on the web at crescentridge.com. We'd like to thank Athenium Hotel and Apartments, the Mount Auburn Club, and Zen Gardens Incorporated for helping make our online auction a success. And thank you for making a bid for the news. 58 degrees under partly sunny skies right now in Boston. This is WBUR.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The mainstream music industry is floundering, an historic decline that many experts say might even be irreversible. Record sales were down 11% last year. But all this seems to be very good news for the thriving world of independent record labels. Scott Alaric, Here and Now's folk critic, is here to tell us about one company that's beating the odds, Compass Records in Nashville. Scott says it's the very model of the modern music indie label, and that for Compass, these are the good old days. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Bill. Great to be here.
Scott, what's going on? Tell me about Compass Records.
Well, the whole independent record label industry seems to be on maybe more of an upswing than the major label industry is on a downswing. A decade ago, indie sales comprised about 5% of all record sales, and it's now over 35%. Now, a lot of that's from rap and hip-hop, and so many of those are on indie labels. But it's really good times for folk music, too. Rounder Records, which is the largest folk indie in the country, had the best year of its 30-year history in 2002 with sales up. And get this, 50% over 2001.
Huh, 50%.
50%.
In any business, that ain't bad.
No, that ain't bad. Now, Compass Records is on track to have its best year ever this year by signing exactly the kind of acts that terrify mainstream marketers, like that little snatch we heard of Salsa Celtica. They go for roots acts with a very modern sensibility, fusion artists, sleekly melodic jazz artists with the kind of universality that jazz diehards often sniff at. But let's listen a little more to Salsa Celtica. These are 11 guys from Glasgow. There's Latin Americans and Americans and Scots in the group. We just heard a little bit of them, and they're just exactly what their name says. Now listen to this. This is how they think Auld Lang Syne sounds.
Even San Juan, more than Glasgow.
That's right.
Now, what is Compass up to? Are they taking risks, or are they just so darn determined to get some of these acts out there that they just throw caution to the wind?
I don't think they're market-driven in the way they think about music at all. What makes their story such an important one and an indicator of maybe where the whole industry is going is that I think that they're a truly post-industrial record label. They started in the mid-90s and have an active stable now of about 47 artists. And at any time, they have about 20 artists touring, and they average 2 to 4 releases per month. They were founded in the mid-90s by bassist Gary West and Grammy-winning banjo player Alison Brown. And I think the fact that they're musicians themselves is very important to the kind of label that they're building. They look for artists who are real self-starters, who have their own careers and have an audience base, and they look for music that they want to support and then find the audience for that music.
Is this a place where newcomers can show up and get a deal?
They tend to pick up people who have pretty active careers already and then help them more. But I don't want to give the impression from that Salsa Celtica thing that they're looking for offbeat or eccentric. They're not a novelty label at all. In fact, their big signing of the last 6 months or so is a guy named Jake Armerding, a Boston songwriter who has more potential than any songwriter I've heard in years. He's got a great folk pop sound, and he is just perfectly poised where the modern roots revival meets the edgy urban songwriter, and he has just a wonderful sense of melody.
It's diverse stuff, but is there a common thread?
Yes, there is. They look for artists who have a very modern approach to some form of roots music or some form of kind of classic popular music. But they're very sophisticated records. They're wonderfully recorded. They're also very melodic. They have a real ear for available music.
Big recent signing, you were telling me, a favorite of mine, Paul Brady, the Irish folk singer, if you want to call him a folk singer.
Well, this is exactly the kind of artist that Compass is signing right now. Paul Brady is just a giant in Ireland. He's actually two of the most influential musicians in the history of Irish music. He's credited with largely inventing the modern Celtic ensemble guitar sound. And as a songwriter, he fuses Celtic ideas to American R&B and pop structures. His songs have been recorded by Mark Knopfler, Bonnie Raitt, Tina Turner, Cher, Dave Edmonds. These guys are artists who are known for their taste in songwriters. Bob Dylan cites Paul Brady as one of his songwriting heroes.
Wow.
Yeah, but he slips through the cracks of the major
labels. Bob doesn't do that all that often.
No, he doesn't. Let's listen here to a little bit. This is a great duet on one of his songs with Irish folk diva Mary Black.
I will be there
when you are lost in the night with nowhere to turn.
I will be there.
Don't be afraid.
Now, are they getting rich at Compass Records?
I don't think they're trying to get rich, but they're doing very, very well. This, to me, maybe is the most astonishing factoid about them. Over 95% of their titles turn a profit.
Whoa.
Yeah. The big secret in the indie label industry is that artists on that level function as their own retailers. So they don't just rely on royalties. They go out and sell their own CDs,
mm-hmm.
where they get the wholesale retail markup and sell them at concerts. So they often earn, you know, $10 or so on every CD sale. So you do the math, even a 10,000 selling CD makes a lot of money for an artist, where in the mainstream music industry, where it costs up to $500,000 just to get a record played on commercial radio, they estimate that a mainstream commercial pop record has to sell 1 million copies before the artist sells 1 million. Well, 98% of the records released sell 5,000 copies or fewer. So obviously the mainstream major labels are missing the vast majority of the marketplace.
Are the mainstream labels noticing? Does it inspire them, do you think, to change their acts at all?
Well, that's the big secret, is can it? It seems to be just the opposite. It seems to be they want to concentrate more and more on that 2%.
So who's buying Compass Records?
Well, this should be very flattering to our listeners because there's actually a buzzword in the industry today of a niche called the NPR listener. And that is absolutely the heart and soul of who Compass is after.
Best people in America.
Yes, absolutely. It tends to be well-educated, a lot of white-collar workers, open-minded, people who don't like to be advertised to but are interested in discovering new things, things outside the music mainstream, and they're willing to look a little farther, and they're willing to open their ears to try something new in order to get something that really moves them. And that's absolutely the heart of who Compass is after and why they're able to do well with people that the music industry doesn't know what to do with. Here's a guy, Gordon Haskell, a British singer, used to be a lead singer with King Crimson, and then spent a couple of decades, as he put it, tarting around. Some real hard life, and you can hear it in his songs, and turned himself into a classic saloon singer. This guy's song was the most requested song in the history of BBC Radio 2. He beat out the Beatles' Hey Jude and Frank Sinatra's My Way.
We need to hear this guy.
Yes, he's like Nora Jones with whiskers and about 100,000 more miles on his odometer.
Things can happen fast. Some things are built to last. I've seen it all go down in Harry's bar. Though we've only just begun, this show will run and run. Do you know how wonderful you are?
Yeah, that's great, sort of smoky, seductive stuff there.
Great groove and what a voice.
Great stuff, great stuff. And thanks for filling us in, Scott, on the great stuff coming out of Compass Records.
Always a pleasure, Bill.
Yeah,
thanks.
Always a pleasure to have you. Here and now is folk critic Scott Ellerick. For more information on Compass Records, visit our website, here-now.org.
But I know it works for me, and I'm sure you will agree that it illustrates exactly how I feel.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston, and today we welcome the listeners of WSKG in Binghamton, New York, gateway to the Finger Lakes region. Welcome.
And welcome indeed. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Though we've only just begun, this show will run and run. Do you know how wonderful you are?
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at MathWorks. Information on the web at MathWorks.